The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Kay Ryan, 16th Poet Laureate Poetry Consultant at the Library of Congress. And she's going to say hello with an opening poem.
Well, I think I'll just choose one at random. How about ideal audience? And this is thinking about who my audience for poetry would be. Not scattered legions, not a dozen from a single region for whom accent matters, not a 7-member coven, not 5 shirt-tail cousins, just 1 free citizen, maybe not alive now even, who will know with exquisite gloom that only we 2 ever found this room.
The voice of Kay Ryan. What a perfect voice. What a perfect poem.
Thank you.
Let's just rely on that. Dumb luck, okay? Thank you and welcome, and especially thank you for being on this show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We're so happy. Everyone will want to know this one thing. What did you feel when you were called and asked to be the Poet Laureate?
I felt completely unequal to the task. I thought, no, never in a million years.
What would equal to the task be?
Well, I have lived a life intentionally hasn't required me to opine about poetry very much, or to represent poetry. I've found it comfortable to represent my own poetry. You know, I feel confident talking about it and thinking about it, but I feel really shaky when I have to generalize beyond my own private, selfish, obsessive interests.
Well, you know what? Maybe being yourself was good enough.
Well,
maybe
it got me here.
It sure did.
We'll see how much farther it gets me.
In the Niagara River poems, you do mention limelight, sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenge will be how to manage that, won't it? How to bring sunlight to the limelight. So that's a big deal.
It would be great to read that poem if we could find it.
I think it's in Say Uncle.
It's called Limelight. And I've found in my writing life an interesting truth, and that is that I have to write about things that are going to be really important to me later, far before they're really important. I have to write when I'm just starting to get an inkling of them. Like this whole business of worrying about being in the limelight. Well, I wasn't in very darn much limelight when I wrote this.
But you knew there was danger there.
I knew there was danger in limelight. Here I found it. Now, I want to tell you, we use that term limelight, and we all know it means being in the spotlight. But in fact, the term limelight comes from before there was electrical lighting in theaters, and they would have these cans of lime or something at the footlights, you know, where
right.
The footlights would be. Mm-hmm. And so that would be limelight. But you can see it would mean you're the person who's lit up. You know, being in the limelight is being lit up, and in an artificial way. It's not regular life.
It was probably phosphorescence or something.
I bet it
like
was
that.
Very phosphorescent, and it was some kind of lime itself. Okay, so here's the little poem. Limelight. One can't work by limelight. A bowlful right at one's elbow produces no more than a baleful glow against the kitchen table. The fruit purveyor's whole unstable pyramid doesn't equal what daylight did.
Kay Ryan. She was born in California and grew up in the small towns of San Joaquin Valley, and the Mojave Desert. She received her bachelor's and master's degree from UCLA. She's published several collections, including The Niagara River, Say Uncle, Elephant Rocks, Flamingo Watching, and that was a finalist for both the Lamont Poetry Selection and the Nanoor Marshall Prize. Strangely Marked Metal and Dragon Acts to Dragon Ends. You're going to be surprised. That's one of my favorite books.
Your first book. Do you have it?
No, I didn't bring it with me, but I'll tell you, I love that book.
Oh.
The work, how do you feel about it?
I feel embarrassed.
Well, that is amazing because Louise Glick says that about her first books.
I think we tend to feel that we don't know what our voice is yet.
That was so juicy, though. It's such a juicy book. It's
and
so full.
We feel maybe we don't know how to be guarded in ways that we later learn how to be guarded. You know, I mean, and I mean by guarded, I don't mean withholding truths, but withholding secrets. But we haven't learned how to manage them. It's like in human relationships when you feel like you've been kind of a mess. You've said too much, or you've said it the wrong way. And you feel embarrassed.
You're all about relationships. You are all about relationships, and I'll give you my theory on that later on. Let's hear another poem.
First of all, I want to tell you a little bit more about Limelight. I just wanted to say, you notice the term is Limelight. I talked about the origin of that term. But in the poem, you notice there's a real trick, because the limelight being referred to is the lime that would come off of off of the fruits, you know, come off of limes themselves.
Which is a growing thing.
Which is so that it's a joke. I mean, it's a silly thing that I'm doing. I mean, to willfully misunderstand what limelight is, and then to talk about trying to write by the light of a bowl of limes. But it's getting at something that is deeply important to me. That this baleful light isn't a good light to write by. It's not natural light. So I just want to point out that I do things that either look stupid or funny, you know, or a person might just miss them. But there is a reason why I've done it.
But Kay, what we see is that it is the balance in your work that you are always finding through paradox. You get paradox, which results in balance. And that poem is a perfect example of finding balance indirectly. And look at the irony. Well, I'm going to just read you, rattle off a few mm-hmm. things that are said about you, and you can raise your hand if you don't like them. Or they're just things I picked up.
Okay.
And I think they're right, for the most part. Big little poems, things are not what they seem, but the reverse, succinct, not personal, the closer you look, the more you see, hidden rhymes, poems are magnifications, tangible realities of intangible states of being. I made that up. I like that one.
That was my favorite so far.
Oh, sly. I do not believe that, because sly... You are sly to me is not totally honest, and your poems are entirely about honesty in thought, word, and deed.
Well, you know, maybe when that writer used the word sly, they wanted to say oblique, you know, at an angle. When we think, we use sly, and it has negative connotations, but it also means coming at something from a new angle.
But cunning is not the same as elucidating, and you don't do it just to trick us. That's the whole point.
No,
it's about intention.
Never. No,
it's
no, no.
It's about intention.
No, no.
Right.
No, to amuse, to briefly mislead and then correct.
Yeah, you're intellectually mischievous.
Yes, definitely. I would say that I am mischievous.
And so my 2.5 cents says, always balancing the material and the non-material, and therefore, it really is always about relationships. Always. So it's always personal. It's always about you in relation to the space or the periphery or the edge. So they are personal.
Well, you know, I would utterly agree. I mean, I think it's in a sense, laughable to say that any poetry is impersonal, because the motive is terribly personal. And if you wind up writing about a cup, there is some personal reason that you're writing about that and some personal way that you're approaching its dimension or color or placement in the universe. So we can't hide ourselves. That's the truth. No poetry, however apparently impersonal, allows us to hide. And if you have hidden, you've really failed. I mean, it means that you've been opaque. It means that you have perhaps written something that's already been written, because your words would be hidden directly behind somebody else's words. They wouldn't exist. They wouldn't exist independently. So
this is
there's no hiding.
She's our 16th poet laureate of the United States, and I just love saying that. It's big.
I love hearing it.
It's big.
It's big.
Let's have another poem.
Big and improbable, I promise you. Oh, another one. Okay. Well,
but there's nothing better than within these marble halls having something alive and throbbing, sometimes unsure. I love that.
Well, you know what? I think I'll read. I just picked up another book, an earlier one. This is Flamingo Watching. And I think I'll read. Here's a poem called This Life. Mm. It has some funny rhymes in it. I used to think when I was younger that I could maybe avoid trouble in life by making myself small. You know, I think a lot of people try to get little and get out of the path of the bullets. This is a poem that kind of thinks about that. This life. It's a pickle, this life. Even shut down to a trickle, it contains every kind of particle that causes strife on a grander scale. To be miniature is to be swallowed by a miniature whale. Zeno knew the law that we know. No matter how carefully diminished, a race can only be half finished with success. Then comes the endless halving of the rest, the ribbon's stalled approach, the helpless, red-faced urgings of the coach.
What I like is after you read, you literally frame the poem in silence, and it's almost part, there's a kind of a pulse beat which you add to the poem, which is a silence. And I'm going to remember that. It adds to the aesthetic of the poem. Here is who she is, our 16th laureate. She won the gold medal for poetry from the San Francisco Commonwealth Club, the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize at Guggenheim, that was the same year, I think, an Ingram Merrill Award, a fellowship from NEA, the Union League Poetry Prize, the Maurice English Poetry Award, 3 pushcarts, and her work has many times been selected for the best American poetry, and it was in the major volume from 88 to 97. And she's here with us today. Also, you've been in the Funnies.
Yes.
On Subways and in the New Yorker. So you've been around. But there's one thing I wonder if you know. There is a website that counts your words. It is hilarious. Did you see that? Zimmerman, it's called. And it takes each one of your books, and it has a chart.
Uh-huh.
And it goes number of sentences in the book, number of words, and then most frequently used words. Is that the oddest thing?
Isn't that peculiar?
Had you known that?
You know, I saw it once years ago, and I thought, how meaningless.
Why?
But what does that show?
Picked you out, though. Well, do you lack some? Would you like some words? Do you need a few
thank
words?
Thank you. I'm always in the market for more words.
Okay. Could we have another poem? Okay, Ryan. That's why you're here.
I think I'll choose another book.
Okay.
Let's see. This time I'll choose Niagara River.
Good.
Oh, this is a very sad poem. I love it, though. It's called He Lit a Fire with Icicles. And it's dedicated to W.G. Sebald, the German author who spent most of his adult life in England and who died prematurely in 2001, just when he was really getting known in the United States, the author of The Rings of Saturn and Austerlitz.
How old was he?
I think he was 55, I think. 44 to 2001. Yep, 55, right? Yeah. His books are, they just bewitch me. There is this strange combination of meditation, philosophy, sort of travelogue, strange photographs that are somewhat ambiguous and blurry, and there's all this seduction of the imagination and the mind, and he just takes you down gardens of forking paths until you are utterly and bewitchingly lost, and also terribly melancholy, but not sad about it.
Bewitchingly lost. We're ready.
All right. So this is a poem about his patron saint, Saint Sebald. This was the work. Okay, this title again. He lit a fire with icicles. This was the work of Saint Sebald, one of his miracles. He lit a fire with icicles. He struck them like a steel to flint, did Saint Sebald. It makes sense only at a certain body heat. How cold he had to get to learn that ice would burn. How cold he had to stay. When he could feel his feet, he had to back away.
And there's that beautiful pause you give at the end, which adds to the line.
I think that one of the torments of a certain kind of writing or writer is, I think we really do need to retain a certain chill. I think a certain chill is essential to work that can survive.
It's going to be hard. I'm Italian.
Well, it's going to be very hard. You don't chill.
No.
But
I understand what you mean by restraint, though.
There has to be
the elegance of restraint, which gives it radiates, doesn't it? Later.
You have to. I think what it does. Like I've sometimes compared the chill to say if you put an ice cube on your hand, your skin would turn pink. You know, when you took the ice cube away, and you would see that your skin was pink where you'd had that ice, because your blood is all sent to where the chill was. So that if you have a somewhat chilly surface in work, it brings the reader's blood to that place.
Whoa. The many things you have said are memorable, and you have made much of silence. I saw you on Jim Lehrer, and you talked about a childhood where your home was silent. And I was wondering, you benefit so much by that. Do you think that silence is your muse in some way, more than for other people?
I don't know so much about muse. I know that it is a necessary nutrient for me. I mean, it is the soil that allows me to put words together. You know, it's the soil of my language. I also think I have, and it's both a curse and a blessing, a very silent mind. Many people have chattering minds. I have a very empty mind. I always laugh that I've always wanted somebody to call up and say to me, Kay, what are you doing? And I say, nothing. And now I have to start all over again.
Did you write that yet? No, that needs to be written. That's the title of a book. I love that. But you do talk about nutrients. And you also talk about failure as a nutrient. Mm-hmm. I think you have a couple of poems about failure in Say Uncle. I think that's in Say Uncle. And Slime Green.
Oh, yeah.
But You say in failure, there is nutrition. And boy, writers need to know that, don't they? Writers know that more than others.
Well, they'd better know it. I'd be happy to read that poem.
That'd be excellent.
You know, one of the reasons that I write about things like failure or doubt.
Page 66.
Is, you know, they're the things I have around me. You know, these are available. These are available subjects. I've always just failed, so it's right there in front of me.
Page 66.
Okay, I have two of them. I have.
Yes, you do. Yeah, failure again.
Yeah, yeah. It's a favorite topic.
Let's do those.
Okay, this one is has a lot of fun sounds in it. Failure, like slime inside a stagnant tank. It's green, deepening from lime to emerald. A dank but less ephemeral efflorescence than success is in general. There's this bloom of failure. I think that's a very funny poem.
And what is the other poem, Failure Again?
This one, this is Failure 2. I thought it was funny to start numbering them. I think I may have dozens eventually. Failure 2. That's the number 2. There could be nutrients in failure. Deep amendments to the shallow soil of wishes. Think of the dark and bitter flavors of black ales and peasant loaves. Think of licorices. Think about the tales of how Indians put fishes under corn plants. Next time hope relinquishes a form, think about that.
Mm. Mm. Kay Ryan, 16th Poet Laureate of the United States, and she's all ours today. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're at the Library of Congress, and we couldn't be happier about that. It doesn't seem like you could get in too much trouble. You live a writer's life, you teach English, and yet you do have poems, Chickens Coming Home to Roost, survival poems, as if there's a lot of danger out there. Do you think that the poet who's most awake sees what there is to fear or to worry about? Because your life looks like they can't get you.
Well, I suppose Emily Dickinson's life would have looked the same way.
Mm.
I don't mean to make any comparisons, except that there are cliffs of fall in all of us, right? What is that, Hopkins? Cliffs of fall? I think it is. Beautiful phrase. I think we have our own precipices inside, and whatever we do to skirt them or postpone them, they come. We arrive at the edge periodically.
Mm-hmm.
So we carry it all around in us, everybody. It's not easy to live. It's not easy for any of us to live.
Well, I hope when I go, I'll have looked at the world as closely as you have, and you teach us how to look at the world. I have a wonderful friend who's a photographer, and I call him the horse's eye, because horses have 20/30 vision, and I see the horse's eye. You see things that no one else sees, whether it's the edge of a table or the corner of a room, and you relate to the corner. Mm-hmm. You relate to mm-hmm. the periphery. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a way to live. What a way to be totally alive. But ambition, we spoke of it before we went on mic, and you said it. We quarreled about what the word meant. I actually don't mean you step up a ladder to go someplace. I mean, it's a passion, a burning passion. And you say yours is inward, burning inward. But that's what I saw most women poets laureate were not women who displayed their ambition.
They didn't need to be public figures, perhaps. They didn't have ambition in the outer world.
But why not? I mean, why didn't they feel they were entitled to the outer world?
I don't know. I really don't have an opinion on that. I would only say that in my case, I haven't been... It might even be a form of selfishness rather than anything that from which I've been kept out. I have been occupied. I've been occupied with my own thinking. I'm a person who likes very little responsibility, and the idea of heaping the expectations of the world or the appetites of the world onto me is obnoxious to me. So I have just pretty much stayed home, ridden my mountain bike, worked as much as I had to make a modest living, and kept my brain empty.
The right kind of ambition.
I mean, it's my ambition, and I'm vicious about it.
But I bet you sleep well at night.
I'm ambitious to have a simple life, you know.
Ambitiously simple. Her poems have been in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Poetry Magazine, The Yale Review, Paris Review, The American Scholar, Three Penny Review, Parnassus, and you've written essays as well. And she was named to the It List by Entertainment Weekly. Now, there we go, the It List. She was elected a chancellor at the Academy of American Poets in 2006, and I believe you must still be a chancellor.
Yes, it's okay. A six-year appointment.
Uh-huh. And this year, of course, Kay Ryan was appointed the Library of Congress's 16th Poet Laureate Consultant in Poetry. She lives in Marin County. May we have another poem, please?
Well, I think I'll just take potluck from another book. Oh, this is good. This is from Elephant Rocks. This poem is called Outsider Art, and it's the result of having looked at a large book of folk art that I had expected to enjoy. For a long time, this poem was called Folk Art rather than Outsider Art, and I couldn't sell it. And when I changed the name to Outsider Art, snap, I got it taken immediately. Hmm. Because, see, there's something more attractive about the outsider, you see?
Yes. Yeah, very attractive right now. The person off stage is always the more interesting person in a play, isn't it? The one off stage.
Outsider, sort of the misfit, you know.
Let's see how it sounds.
Okay. Outsider art. Most of it's too dreary or too cherry red. If it's a chair, it's covered with things the Savior said or should have said. Dense admonishments in nail polish, too small to be read. If it's a picture, the frame is either burnt matches glued together or a regular frame painted over to extend the picture. There never seems to be a surface equal to the needs of these people. Their purpose wraps around the backs of things and under arms. They gouge and hatch and glue on charms till likable materials, apple crates and canning funnels, lose their rural ease. We are not pleased the way we thought we would be pleased.
There's that silence I love so much in you. Those people never purpose for those people.
There's never purpose. There never seems to be a surface equal to the needs of these people. It's a kind of a mad, obsessed quality that one feels in looking at much outsider art. It isn't adjusted, you know. It isn't wholesome the way we think folk art, you know, a nice quilt of the American flag or something. There's something urgent and hungry and restless in it, and savage in a way. And I thought when I was writing this poem that I really was talking about the kinds of images I'd seen in this book of folk art. But I eventually realized that the laugh was on me, because I was really talking about myself too.
Well, it's that we don't want to take that rawness as much as we create the poem and burnish it. If there isn't that rawness underneath, forget it.
You are right.
Absolutely.
You are right.
paradox and argument I mentioned before, and your poems are called Little Arguments, and I was wondering about the dialectic in your head. How were you raised so that you questioned yourself, and you questioned and you turned the word on edge, and then you turned it upside down, and then you saw inside of it. That dialectic is a way of thinking. Where do you think you got that? I mean, you weren't raised in the monastery where you had to learn St. Thomas Aquinas. Where did that come from?
You know, that's a very good question. Nobody's even come close to asking me that before. And I really appreciate a good question and a new question because it requires new thinking. I imagine that I developed this kind of but response, you know, but wait a minute, or look at the other side, from being a reader, from the fact that most of the writing that I do is not directly in response to something that I've read necessarily, although some poems have an epigraph, but that it is through reading something difficult, something exciting, that my mind comes to some new little perception, some new little thing, so that I am I'm in conversation with what I read, what I have read. Lots of times in the morning, I read something really difficult, really thrillingly intellectual.
Something.
I love to read the essays of Milan Kundera. He's just wonderful. Or Calvino, or Nabokov, or Brodsky. But now look, I don't ever read poetry. I don't read fiction. I don't read natural history. I don't read science. I read essentially aesthetic essays, essays about literature, about the mind, and often by poets, but I read their essays, and it sort of cranks my mind up to a certain speed.
But I think that as a child, not to go to psychobabble, but I was not allowed really to raise questions in the house. I don't know how it was with you, but somewhere along the line, just for your personality formation, you started arguing.
I started arguing. I've never really been much of a public thinker or talker. My partner is a wonderful thinker, and she can think extended thoughts, and loves to do so, and would love to have her mate in that area. And I'm not. I'm a very lazy thinker with others.
Well, that laziness just got you to be the 16th poet laureate of the United States. So I say, let's bottle it. Let us bottle it. Can we have another poem? Kay Ryan is here with us.
This is lots of fun. Okay. So I've got one more book here with me.
I have tons of them.
This is from Flamingo Watching.
That's a good book.
I'm always asking for less, you know, who is it? Oliver Twist, who holds up his bowl and says, more, please. I hold up my bowl and say, less, please. here's a poem asking for less. It's a vacation poem. And I really think some of our overstressed, listeners might enjoy this vacation. Vacation. It would be pleasant to walk in Stonehenge or other places that have rocks arranged on the basis of a plan or plans inscrutable to modern man. To wander among grinders sunk deep in sheep pastures or simply set on top Peruvian grit. To gaze up at incisors no conceivable jaw could fit. To stretch to be ignorant enough, scoured to a clean vessel, as pure as the puzzle, vestal to a mystery involving people, but without the heat of people.
Everyone should go buy those books. Go into the bookstore, and they'll be loading up on them now. That was Flamingo Watching. We have heard from Say Uncle today, also the Niagara River, and Strangely Marked Metals, Elephant Rocks. I have that at home. I didn't bring it. And Dragon Axe to Dragon Ends. It's fulsome. It's a very full-spirited book.
But you can't get it because all the copies are locked away in my attic.
Well,
Dragon Axe to Dragon Ends. It was self-published, essentially.
Yeah, but you know, it's in the libraries.
Not many. It's in the Library of Congress.
Absolutely, it's in the library. It's in Maryland libraries.
Huh.
And people
How
can
did
go
they
to
get
the library.
It?
You can go to the library and just say, Kay Ryan, and give a list of her books. But do you know what's going to happen this year, I'm sure? All of these will go into a collected book.
I'm going to have
That's
a
great.
New one selected in April of 2009.
Okay. Who's going to choose the poems?
I am.
And will you be able to choose? Can you fit all of them in?
No, it's going to be a selected.
But you could. How are you going to make that decision?
Well, I'm going to get rid
Who's
of the ones
help
I
you?
Don't like.
Who's going to help you?
My partner, Carol.
Okay. You're in good hands, right?
Right.
Who did help you in your career?
Carol. Carol. I just am the kind of writer who can't be helped in so many ways. I couldn't join any clubs that would have me. I couldn't learn from anybody.
You didn't get in the poetry club at college.
I didn't get in the poetry club at UCLA. I mean, there were a few times when I weakened and actually thought, oh, okay, I'll try to be like other people. I'll try to, you know, network. That was before the word network was used.
But it wasn't right.
It didn't
you.
Fit me
it
at
wasn't.
All. I just had to go out in the wilderness of my own mind and backyard and write and write and write. And it eventually, and then, I, you know, I mailed out to little magazines sporadically, and they would always send them back. My poems didn't look like anybody else's, and they weren't interested. So I got this stack that just got higher and higher, you know, hundreds of poems just stacked up on my desk on yellow tablet paper, and it was got to be very depressing what was going to become of this work. And finally, Carol just sort of took me in hand and said, all right, we're going to do this in an orderly way. You know, tell me some magazines you'd like to be in. Okay. Tell me the poems that you think are worth sending out. And she would put them in groups, send them out, and she did it dispassionately. And she said, if we get in one magazine out of 100, that's great.
I'm begging her a peach pie.
Yeah, yeah. And so I just don't know what would have become of me because I had
you
no
wouldn't be
skills.
Sitting here.
I had no skills to get across, you know. So she could make that bridge for me.
Your associate producer.
Absolutely. And I can't tell you how gratifying this is for her.
Oh, this is her victory as
it
well.
It is.
It surely is. Kay Ryan is here, and it's the happiest day of the year for us. We promised to talk a little bit about technology because, look, it's here, you know.
Right.
What are you going to do with it? The hardware drives the software. That's the scary part because when I was with PBS, I realized that every new piece of machinery that came out pushed new programming.
Right.
So let us know what you feel. People are going to know you through online, perhaps more than your collected poems. What do you feel about that?
Well, I think, all right, the poems are available online, you know, in written form. They look like a poem. Some of them. They can be accessed. Quite a few of mine are online. I mean, by quite a few, I mean maybe 50, something like that. So they can be read, although I much prefer the privacy of a book that you can carry into a corner, that you can take with you. It has an intimacy that I am unable to derive from a computer screen, but I'm an older generation, and there may be an intimacy available to younger people that I just don't know about. But I am a writer who really, my primary interest is the poem on the page, whether it's a screen or a paper page. I want it to be seen. I've arranged it in a particular way for reasons. I am very gratified if, when I hear somebody read my poem, they read it very much as I would have. And that happens a lot, I'm satisfied to say.
That means the words are true.
It can be read. It's like a soup, you know. You have to reconstitute dried, you know, soup powder, you know. So this the powder of the poem is there on the page, but it's reconstituted in the mind, and it comes out of the reader's mouth, sounding very much like what I put in, you know, what I powdered up there. So my primary love is for the poem on the page. I have high expectations for it. There are amusements available only through seeing it. A lot of the rhyme things that go on are mostly fun when you look at them on the page, even though they're kind of invisible. That's what I like. They're sneaky and they come out at you in funny ways when you're able to study it on the page. The poem, the spoken poem, goes by so fast.
Well, but when I say online, I do not mean audio. I mean that your poems, of course, not all of them, but some will be seen online. It won't always be audio. But what they will lack is the silence of the page, because people will just put them where they want to put them, you know, jam them up, and you really need space.
It's true. If I have any control in a book layout, I want my small poems on a good-sized page in isolation, kind of in the middle of the page. I also, if you in the radio audience are not seeing my poems, so you don't know they're quite narrow. I was looking at a comb yesterday, just a black ace comb, and if you thought of an ace comb with slightly jagged teeth, that would be like looking at one of my poems from the side.
That's about right. I actually, about 20 lines or so.
Yeah.
I actually was just leaving through to look at the very few two-page poems you have.
And those are really cheaters. It's just the way my press tends to, they take what would really be a one-page poem and they drop the beginning so low on the page that they have to extend it to a second page. And they do that to make my many, many short poems look centered on the page. So it's kind of a compromise they make.
Well,
they drop the beginning of the poem down low.
But there's no way it could really, some of your poems, there's no way it could be on one page. About
very
three
few.
Of them,
yeah,
I would
yeah,
say
very
three.
Few. Yeah.
Kay Ryan is here. She's the 16th Poet Laureate of the United States, and she is going to be someone that will give us all hope for our little wishes, dreams, failures. And she has told us how she handled disappointment, and that meant getting Carol to put it all together.
Well,
getting help.
You know, I was talking to Carolyn Brown, Dr. Carolyn mm-hmm. Brown, last night at dinner, and we were talking about how need, the very pressure of need itself, has a way of sort of extruding answers or discovering help. Need is some kind of, and this sounds really woo-woo, but I don't mean it to be, but it is some kind of energy that almost calls into being help of some sort.
Well, if you're lucky. Okay, here's the distinction I see. You do not approach the world with need. That's different. You had a need for a project, and it had the passion acted as the hydraulic. But people who approach life with nothing but need get need back.
Mm.
I mean, that is new age. That is woo-woo stuff. But people who have nothing but need, you know how people come to you with nothing but need? Well, it doesn't work. But now for a project where you have, this is earned need. You had hours and hours and days of work. That's a different thing.
I think what I mean is you have when you have a question, a burning question, a problem that has got to be solved. It's just preoccupying you. And everything starts to comment on that.
Uh-huh.
You accidentally hear something on the radio that is just absolutely what you need to hear. You read something in the paper. You see something. I don't know. But information becomes available to you, and it's somehow because of that extreme need. It might be a sensitivity in you, or there could be some kind of exchange going on.
That is quantum physics.
Well,
that's
you know.
That's called calling it in. No, that's a different thing than just need. That is really vibrating towards something in the universe that you really want. And that's a very strong thing.
I'm going to read you a poem. Not that you've asked me to do it, but this is from Flamingo Watching, and it's a poem which has a title, the words of Charles Darwin. This is taken from his marvelous autobiography, which I recommend if you haven't read it. It's wonderfully simple. He wrote it to his grandchildren, and it is so marvelous. So that's the autobiography of Charles Darwin. And he said, he would be, this is the context for the epigraph, he would be going to school and he would be dawdling, looking at things and fooling around, and it would be almost time to be at school and he'd get in big trouble if he wasn't there on time. And he would run as fast as he could and he would pray that he would make it on time, and he would make it on time. And he said, I marveled at how generally I was aided. And he meant aided by God. You know, he was able to get there on time. I marveled at how generally I was aided. And this poem is a poem that is talking about needing and getting. I marvel at how generally I am aided, how frequently the availability of help is demonstrated. I've had unbridgeable distances collapse and opposite objects coalesce enough to think duress itself may be a prayer. Perhaps not chance, but need selects, and desperation works upon giraffes until their necks can reach the necessary branch. If so, help alters, makes seven vertebrae go farther in the living generation. Help coming to us, not from the fathers, not to the children.
Exactly what you were saying.
I wrote that a long time ago.
Do you also, I know that you're in touch with everything that's invisible, mostly past voices, past authors, but is part of being in touch with the invisible part of your strength? I'm not calling it prayer. I'm not calling it meditation. But I definitely plug in. I definitely plug in to get what I need.
I think that the invisible that is most important to me is the great writers of the past. I mean, they are my comfort and my solace and my community and my friends in a very deep and abiding way.
And a variety of them. You say Italo Calvino is a favorite of yours, as a fabulous. What about fable? I don't see fable in your work that much.
I don't really read his fables.
Oh.
I'm very.
You like his essays?
I am not of the narrative persuasion, as you see in reading my work. I like to read murder mysteries, but in a way, I'm talking about, you know, being interested in story or narrative. And I was thinking, well, yeah, murder mysteries are stories. But I don't read them. I read a lot of them, but I don't read them either for the plot or to know who done it. Because I usually have forgotten much of the many of the clues by the time I get to the end anyhow. So I never have much of an idea who did it. But I like the detectives rooting around in the homes of the dead or the suspects. I like them opening drawers and looking behind curtains and under couches.
Which is just what you do in your poetry. That's what you like. That's why I'm on to you. But I think there is something more I can't even, I think somebody's going to want to categorize your poetry. We cannot call it narrative. We cannot call
no.
it. But there is lyricism in it. There certainly is lyricism in the balance of those words. Philosophical lyricism. Argumentative lyricism. We just have to make up a new category for you. But could we have another poem?
Well, I don't know why not. I think I'll read you a really frightening one. We should scare everybody, don't you think?
That's what writers do.
That's right. Okay. This one is called Home to Roost. And, of course, it's referring to your chickens are coming home to roost. And we always say that in a minatory way, meaning you've made a number of bad decisions, and now they are revisiting you. They're never good chickens, are they? It's never, you've been kind 1,000 times, and now here is a big cake. So, home to roost. And it's kind of ridiculous, and people tend to think it's funny at first, and then they gradually think it isn't so funny, because it starts with chickens flying. And, of course, chickens don't fly. The chickens are circling and blotting out the day. The sun is bright, but the chickens are in the way. Yes, the sky is dark with chickens, dense with them. They turn, and then they turn again. These are the chickens you let loose, one at a time, and small, various breeds. Now they have come home to roost, all the same kind, at the same speed.
That is thrilling. That is thrilling. I love that.
I wrote it. I don't remember the circumstances. I was very unhappy with myself when I wrote it. No doubt, in the sense of feeling that I'd made a lot of choices that had trapped me. I'd been a fool. I'd been foolish to make these decisions, and now I was stranded and the victim of them. But the awful thing is that I sent this poem to a New York editor in 2001, and it was sitting on her desk in the village, in the Greenwich Village, within sight of the Twin Towers on the occasion of 9/11. And when it is thought about in relationship to that event, which was so cataclysmic that it warped all language around it, everything was changed for a period of time to seem to be commenting upon the event of 9/11. Suddenly, this poem seemed to be saying, America, you have done a lot of things that have caused these chickens, these planes,
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
come and to come home to roost. And I think that's an argument that can be made, in fact. But I don't think it certainly wasn't one I wanted to make right then. I had to call up as soon as the phones were working and say, please send that poem back. I had to.
Oh. You just could not have that as evidence.
It was too cruel at that moment.
Which, of course, was not your intention. There's not a cruel bone in your poetry. There is just not one bit of cynicism. That is actually why I quarreled with this. J.D. McClatchy says some nice things, and he says that you're as intense as an elliptical as Dickinson, okay, as buoyant and rueful as Frost. I didn't think that was true. Buoyant, yes. Rueful, no. I don't see disappointment in your work. I see the opposite of that. I see how it was once, like somebody who used to be in a room, but what is now, I do not see ruefulness in your work.
I wouldn't quarrel with ruefulness.
You mean you agree that he's right?
I think there are a lot of poems that are sort of locked rooms. You don't get out. They don't end on a there is no escape from them. I think really that Home to Roost would be one of those. I have another one which I'd be glad to read.
Thank
of the
you.
Same of the same variety. I mean, let me see if I can find it. I must be in the wrong book. I know we can edit out all the...
Yes. Do you know the title?
Yeah, it's... here it is. I've got it. It's called Corners.
Mm.
And actually, I have two here. They're both terribly... they're trapped. They're closed. Yeah, there's something in mysteries called locked door, or locked room mysteries. And that is something occurs, some terrible thing, occurs in a room in which nobody could get in or out. In other words, how did this happen? Nobody could get in or out to do it. They couldn't get in to do it, and they couldn't get out having done it. But there's a dead body in there or whatever. So there are certain poems that I have that I think are very frightening. They're about states of mind that are desperate states and from which the poem offers no escape. I assure you that they were temporary conditions, though. I did get
out
in time.
We're so glad you're feeling better. That's what Reed Whitmore said. When I wrote this poem, it was just a bad day.
That's right. We always have to say that. Corners. And this is about painting yourself into a corner. You know, we always say, don't paint yourself into a corner. Bit of folk wisdom. All but saints and hermits mean to paint themselves toward an exit, leaving a pleasant ocean of azure or jonquil ending neatly at the door sill. But sometimes something happens, a minor dislocation by which the doors and windows undergo a small rotation to the left a little, but repeatedly. It isn't obvious immediately. Only toward evening and from the farthest corners of the houses of the painters comes a chorus of individual keening, as of kenneled dogs someone is mistreating.
I remember that poem. There is one redeemable thing which keeps it from ever being cynical, and that is that there is energy. Whatever room, locked room you're in, there is the energy of someone who is there.
Oh, interesting.
And that, or it wouldn't work. It wouldn't be a living thing. And even the poems that you think are closed off, somebody was there. And that's as if the person has just left. I call it the person off stage. But energy is your friend. Energy is your friend.
Well, in this case, somebody's been...
Yeah, they're scary. That's
somebody's
scary.
Somebody's been... I mean, it's a terrifying thought to think here you are in a room and there's an exit but the room shifts like, you know, one of those old carousels, you know. It shifts and the doorway becomes unavailable to you.
There's apartments in Dubai now where each floor rotates. Can you... And I said to my husband, what's the egress? How do you get out on a fire escape? You know,
right.
And also there's danger outside of this place.
We don't know.
What are the dogs?
Well, that's just really a metaphor for the sounds of these people stuck in their houses. Only toward evening and from the farthest corners of the houses of the painters comes a chorus of individual keening as of kenneled dogs someone is mistreating.
Kenneled.
Yeah, so it's like the people are stuck in the way that kenneled dogs.
But the writer has been there, and the writer left her energy there. So we're saved again, saved again by the writer. And we will probably be able to have one or two final poems. Is there one thing you'd like to tell the world at all, like go to the library or...
I would like to say keep the libraries open.
Oh, I love the
libraries. Keep the libraries open. Cherish your branch libraries. Don't let a single library close. Have the maximum hours. Libraries are our freedom. I mean, I think even to the degree that schools are. I mean, libraries are truly democratic. Anybody can go in there and teach herself. And be free.
And if you ask the librarian to get you a book, they will go to Chicago, Illinois.
Where else do you find somebody whose joy it is to help you? I mean, you go, who but a librarian is really, truly glad to see you? Oh, glad. What's your question? Wonderful.
And they don't act put upon at
They're
all, do they?
They're not put upon.
No.
They're being used.
You know what? The librarians are going to stand up as one to carry you in their parade, library parade.
I got a letter yesterday from a poor branch librarian in a small town in Oregon who said that their town is a mill town and the lumber industry is shutting down and there is no money for the library. The library has been closed. There's no library now. And she wants to try to get the library going, kind of like public radio, those who can contribute, but then it's open for all. And I just thought, oh, what hard times we're on. I mean, we've got to have libraries. We've got to have them. And the least of these are the ones that are the most exciting to me. The ones where, I mean, thinking about poetry, as I am, we have no idea where poets come from, but I'm quite convinced they come from the least predictable and what appears to be the least fertile locations. And therefore, the public library is an absolutely essential thing to the 6-year-old poet right now, who's going to that library and who's finding their refuge and release an opening that really never closes.
Did you?
I did. I lived in the very small towns of the Central Valley of California, the San Joaquin Valley, and my family, we were working class, and the bookmobile came to some of the towns where we lived, little tiny burgs, and at other times, we rented houses that were near little branch libraries, and they meant a great deal to me. Sometimes they were no bigger than a double garage, you know.
I can smell the books on the shelf from childhood.
Yeah.
We are talking to Kay Ryan, and that is the voice of Kay Ryan. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry for funding the series. Our associate producer is Ken Flynn. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we are not alone because we have Kay Ryan this year. Thank you.
Thank you.
What a powerful and beautiful program.
Before you move the mic,
yes.
Do we want to get a couple of extra poems,
I think we've got enough to fill. Uh-huh.
And also, you didn't do the mid break. You want to do that?
Okay, I'll do it right now.
Okay.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Kay Ryan, 16th Poet Laureate of the United States. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we'll be right back.
And now you do that.
Well, you know, I usually just did that when I had two poets. We'll do it with the music. Okay.
Yeah.
We're back. I'm Grace Cavalieri with Kay Ryan, and here she is again.
It's great to be among pros. You know, it's so great that you guys know what you're doing so well.
Well, you know, it's good to have a God among men.